for WMRA News, I'm Bob Levicky. Charlottesville police arrest a man who took a historic marker memorializing the site of slave auctions. Meanwhile, Tuesday was crossover day in the General Assembly, the deadline for any bill to be passed through one chamber for consideration in the other, and we'll take a look at where some of those bills stand now. And we explore the legacy of Harrisonburg's controversial urban renewal projects in the 50s and 60s. This is the WMRA Daily for Wednesday, February 12th. Charlottesville police have arrested a man who admitted to taking a historic marker memorializing the site of slave auctions. Richard H. Allen III, age 74, was arrested on Tuesday, according to a press release from the city. Allen told multiple news outlets that he removed the plaque because he believed it was insulting to enslaved Africans and their descendants. The marker, which went missing last week, was built into a sidewalk in Charlottesville's Court Square. Allen told the Washington Post that he removed the historic marker with a crowbar and then threw the plaque into the James River. He declined to tell police where the marker could be found, according to Charlottesville Police Chief Rashal Brackney. Allen told the Post he was among the group of counter-protesters at the deadly Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville in 2017. Local governments across Virginia may soon be able to start removing Confederate statues now that lawmakers in Richmond are taking action, Virginia Public Radio's Michael Pope reports.
Communities across Virginia have wanted to ditch their Confederate monuments for years, but it's been a lost cause because they didn't have the authority. Until now, Democrats in the House of Delegates passed a bill giving local governments the authority to remove all those statues of Robert E. Lee and Johnny Reb. Delegate Charles Poindexter says giving local governments that authority is a mistake.
Removing the memory of bad actions takes away the great gift of learning from mistakes. So now we're being told that our forefathers were not nation builders, but slaveholding villains who should be erased from the history books.
The bill giving local governments the authority to remove those statues was introduced by Delegate Dolores McQuinn.
Then when you have statues and monuments that are high and lifted up and people riding on their horse, sending words of intimidation to a certain population, reminding that population that they were once subservient, that they were to be submissive. That's why they're big. That's why they're large. That's why they're in the public square.
The new Democratic majority in the House also passed a bill calling for the removal of the statue of Robert E. Lee from the crypt of the U.S. Capitol, although they decided not to take action on a bill calling for the removal of segregationist Harry Byrd from Capitol Square. Reporting from the Capitol in Richmond, Michael Pope.
We'll have more news from the General Assembly in a moment, but also on Tuesday, a judge tossed out a libel lawsuit filed by Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax against CBS. Fairfax had accused the network of slanted reporting on sexual assault allegations against him. U.S. District Judge Anthony Trenga in Alexandria dismissed the lawsuit, but he declined to grant CBS's request that the network be awarded attorney's fees. He disagreed with the network's contention that the lawsuit amounted to an abuse of the legal process. Fairfax sued CBS for $400 million in September after the network aired exclusive interviews with two women, Vanessa Tyson and Meredith Watson, both of whom accused him of sexual assault more than 15 years ago. Fairfax says the encounters were consensual and argued in the lawsuit that the network reported the allegations in a way that insinuated his guilt. CBS lawyers defended the network's journalism and accused Fairfax of using the lawsuit to attack his accusers. All right, back to the General Assembly. Virginia's electricity grid will get a carbon-free makeover under a plan that cleared the House and Senate on Tuesday. But some environmentalists and Republicans are still skeptical. Ben Pavier with partner station VPM in Richmond reports.
Under the so-called Clean Economy Act, 100% of Virginia's electricity will have to come from carbon-free sources like wind or nuclear power. Democratic Delegate Rip Sullivan, who was sponsoring the bill, says it would address climate change and boost the state economy.
As we prepare for what we know is coming, it seems to me that the time to act is now.
But Republicans like Delegate Israel Quinn are skeptical the effects would help Southwest Virginia, where coal is still king.
Virginia only works correctly and justly if every region is lifted up.
Other critics say the legislation doesn't do enough to protect consumers from big power bills. Lawmakers will now have to hash out the deadline for going carbon free. The House version says 2045, while the Senate approved 2050. Ben Pavier, Capitol Square.
Well, the House and Senate have approved separate bills that would increase the state's minimum wage. The House bill would increase the wage floor in phases to $15 per hour by 2023. The first increase would take effect July 1st and would raise the wage from $7.25 to $9 per hour. The legislation also adds domestic workers to the list of employees who should be paid the minimum wage. The Senate bill would raise the minimum wage to $11.50 per hour by 2023 and then establish various wage regions with similar median incomes and costs of living. In 2024, those regions would then be allowed to establish their own minimum wage. The Senate bill also carves out more than a dozen exemptions, including farm and domestic workers and people under the age of 16. The two chambers will now consider each other's bills. The General Assembly cleared its procedural halfway point on Tuesday. It's called Crossover Day because it's the deadline for bills to be advanced through one chamber or the other to avoid being killed for the session. And so far in this year's session, Democrats have advanced major legislation on issues ranging from abortion to gun control. Republicans find themselves with less influence than in the past. Ben Pavier has that story.
A year ago, Republican delegate Rob Bell was one of the most powerful lawmakers in the House. He chaired the Courts of Justice Committee, which squashed Democratic bills on guns and marijuana. This year, he's sticking to less controversial topics.
So I've had bills that have addressed issues like how do you quarantine rabid dogs and whether we can have albuterol inhalers at schools.
Democrats have sometimes compromised on bigger legislation. Senator Amanda Chase says she was able to help convince Democratic delegate Mark Levin to make changes to his assault weapons ban, lowering the charge for offenders from a felony to a misdemeanor.
It's still a terrible bill, but it's not as bad as it could have been.
Democrats say voters spoke clearly in November, and now they're making good on campaign promises. Ben Pavier, Capitol Square.
Should Virginia drop out of the Electoral College? Well, one lawmaker wants to make that happen. Virginia Public Radio's Michael Pope reports.
Virginia has 13 electoral votes, and the way it works now is they all go to the presidential candidate who gets the most votes in Virginia. But Democrats in the House of Delegates passed a bill that would instead cast those electoral votes for the winner of the nationwide popular vote, an attempt to essentially bypass the Electoral College. Republican Delegate Lee Ware says that's a mistake.
The idea of the majority vote of all the citizens in a direct popular vote, that was considered, it was debated, and it was rejected in 1789.
To make that point, he quoted Federalist Number 68, written by Alexander Hamilton. Delegate Mark Levin is a Democrat from Alexandria who introduced the bill to join the National Popular Vote Compact, and he says Hamilton was wrong.
If Hamilton thinks that the best considered vote of the people is a few people in a closed room, I would suggest to you that the best way to determine the vote of the people, with due respect to Alexander Hamilton, is to consult the people and let them cast their votes.
If Virginia ends up joining the compact, those 13 electoral votes might end up going to a candidate who actually lost here in Virginia, if that candidate won the popular vote across the country. Reporting from the Capitol in Richmond, Michael Pope.
Finally today, in the late 1950s and early 60s, with funding from the Department of Housing and Urban Development, Harrisonburg declared eminent domain over homes and businesses in the northeast section of the city. That included the area known as Newtown, where many formerly enslaved people had made their homes and where many of their descendants still lived. In the first of a two-part report, WMRA's Randy B. Hagee has the story.
If you go around asking about racial history as it relates to housing in Harrisonburg, inevitably the following phrases will come up.
Project R4
knocked on people's doors and told them they were taking their land.
The fiasco, better known as urban renewal.
The Harrisonburg Northeast Urban Renewal Project R4, as it was formerly referred to in city documents, and its smaller tag on Project R16, changed the fabric of the town's black community. The Harrisonburg Redevelopment and Housing Authority, which now runs three subsidized housing complexes and distributes Section 8 housing vouchers, was initially established in 1955 in order to execute the project.
But I like to call it urban removal because it was where cities declared urban areas as slums and they received federal dollars to come in there and to literally displace and replace area residents to rebuild new housing.
Stan Macklin, who runs the Harriet Tubman Cultural Center in Harrisonburg, learned about this local history when he moved here 20 years ago.
There were several businesses that was in the area, the Colonnade, pool halls, restaurants. They just never came back.
To justify an urban renewal project, municipalities had to identify areas of urban blight, or slums, to be eligible for federal funds. They could then take the properties through eminent domain and clear the land for redevelopment. But the area defined in Project R4, bounded by North Main, Broad, Johnson, and Rock Streets, contained homes and apartments of a wide range of value. Many rental properties had outdoor toilets, and tenants had to do their own home repairs.
And see, this was so close to Main Street that the well-to-do whites, certain ones, they wanted to get this area cleaned up, and they wanted to move the blacks into an area where they could not be seen easily.
But author and retired teacher Ruth Tolliver, who grew up spending summers in Harrisonburg, remembers other homes as well.
These were the homes which could never be described as blighted or slums. They just happened to be in the way of progress. These were the homes with the manicured lawns, well-tended flowers, and in some cases, the wraparound porches.
Many of the aforementioned rental properties were owned by a few landlords, including the Klingsteins. Between 1960 and 1963, the Klingsteins sold 14 parcels to the Housing Authority. This included 26 housing structures and a few commercial buildings in the R4 area, many of them along Federal Alley, and additional properties in the R16 area. All told, the Klingsteins were paid close to $150,000 for these properties.
Not very many people owned their own homes, but the homes that they lived in, they took care of them as their own because the landlords back at that time really didn't take care of their homes. They didn't remodel. They didn't fix things. So the residents that lived in those homes took care of them as their own.
Karen Thomas, president and founder of the Northeast Neighborhood Association, said her family was one of many who lived in a Klingstein rental.
My family, they had came from Grottoes, Virginia, to come to Harrisonburg because, you know, to them, that was the city and that's where all the jobs were. But when this happened, they lived in a house that was not theirs, owned by Klingstein. And they ended up moving back to Grottoes, back to family.
Ruth Tolliver and her sister spent summers with their grandmother in Harrisonburg, where she met her husband, Lowell Tolliver.
For us, summers were the time that we were footloose and fancy free. And Harrisonburg was one of those places where you were safe. We rode our bicycles all over town, and everybody knew everybody.
In Tolliver's book, Keeping Up with Yesterday, which is part memoir, part genealogical research, she recounts the evening her husband's childhood home, which his father had built, was destroyed.
We were at the new home on Myrtle Street when my husband Lowell came in and said he had just come by Mason Street and saw the original home place being torched. A silence permeated the home as though a family member had died. We could smell the burning no matter where we went in the house. The home they had all worked so hard for was no longer there, replaced later by an auto parts store, all in the name of progress.
For Tolliver and many others, the pain of that destruction can still be felt. For WMRA News, I'm Randy Behage.
In her second report tomorrow, Randy will explore the modern-day legacy of that project. And you can learn more at WMRA.org and on the WMRA app. For WMRA News, I'm Bob Levicki. Thanks for listening, and enjoy your Wednesday.